Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter. A warm welcome to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in and welcome back to the podcast. We hope you had a nice summertime and, if you're following from the southern hemisphere, winter. In today's podcast, we're going to be discussing displacement and more specifically how to anticipate and mitigate the impacts of climate change on displacement.
Our guest today is Andrew Harper, Special Advisor on Climate Action to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And in his role, he is responsible for providing strategic guidance, oversight, and expertise to shape the UNHCR's response to the climate emergency and driving a more ambitious approach to empowering those on the front line. Welcome, Andrew.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You might not know this, but this is our first in-person podcast recording here in our messy Adelphi recording studio. This is really exciting for us. We generally do this online. So to our listeners, please forgive us if there's anything wrong with the audio. This is a completely new setting. We're going to make it work. But yeah, stick around.
Yeah, it's good that we don't have video going at the moment, so you can't see all of the events materials that surround us.
Yeah.
Perfect. So let's start a little bit by setting the stage, maybe talking about some things at the global level. And I want to kick us off talking about definitions. And despite how frequently the term is used, climate refugee doesn't actually exist as a legal definition. So our first question to you is a little bit twofold. So one, do you actually use the term climate refugee? And how do you approach this in your work? And then two, how does this affect the role of the UNHCR and how it's able to go about its work and protect those affected by the impacts of climate change?
Okay, now thanks for that. And the fact that you're mentioning climate refugee means that I am talking about it and I am mentioning it. It's an evocative term. It's a simple term. It's getting more and more usage. Is that bad? No, I don't necessarily think so, because it's bringing to the fore the human dimension of climate change and the need for protection, because what climate is doing is not dissimilar to what conflict often does. It's causing people to, and some of the most vulnerable and innocent people, to be forced from their homes and being forced to move to locations where they can seek safety. One of the challenges with the climate emergency, though, is there's no real safe places because everywhere is being impacted. And where communities might be fleeing from due to combination of conflict or climate, they're moving to other locations which may be just as desperate. And so if it can bring a degree of urgency, if it can bring the required protection needs to the fore, then I'm not pushing against it. I'd probably just be seeking to clarify that technically the term doesn't exist. And there's some important reasons why we push back on that. One is that the refugee definition, the 951 definition relating to the status of refugees, is so important in terms of international protection that we do not and cannot afford for it to be diffused or confused. And so when we talk about the status of refugees, we're talking about people who cross international borders. And when we talk about people who've crossed international borders, we're talking about people who have had to leave because of a well-founded fear of persecution or discrimination. This can be quite technical, but when we do look at why people have been persecuted or discriminated, it's generally because of race, religion, nationality, or membership of a particular social group. This is like the lawyers coming out, but that does not say that when there's a climate impact or disaster, that certain populations may not be given the same rights as others. And so there may be grounds in a response to an emergency or a disaster that communities may be persecuted and discriminated, and they may have grounds to gain refugee status under the 51 Convention. So what we're trying to ensure is that when people are forced to move, that there is some standard of protection available. And what we generally have also found is that if you look at, for instance, Africa, they've got the OAU expanded definition, which relates to situations where people are being forced to flee due to events seriously disturbing public order. And that's actually quite a wide interpretation and can apply to disasters. So also in South America, you've got the Cartagena Declaration, which has also got a similar approach. So we're generally seeing that in areas which are being impacted by a combination of climate and conflict, that there are already existing instruments which can be applied. One of the challenges is actually operationalizing them. And that's what one of our key elements and key objectives that we're trying to do. The other issue, and I'll try not to talk too much, but once you get me going, I can't stop, is that it sort of like distracts a bit, because the people who are fleeing across an international border in times of conflict and where those countries are being impacted by climate change, they generally meet the 51 Convention. And so 70% of the world's refugees, and this is even taking into account Ukraine, which is not part of this, but 70% of the world's refugees have originated from countries that are being already impacted by climate change and got the least capacity to adapt. And this is something which we've been dealing with decades. So just in the last few years, it's becoming a big issue. But in many aspects, we've been dealing with the nexus or the confluence between conflict and climate for many years. Like you can go back to Sudan and Darfur, and some people might say Syria, and that's an open question about what the impact was there. But does the impacts of climate change lead to increased vulnerability and fragility and potential conflict and displacement? Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about that. And there was discussions yesterday with the Potsdam Institute, and we've done work with Adelphi as well, looking at the confluence and the drivers for conflict. And if climate change is impacting people's ability to survive, if it's destroying crops and livestock, and if people's resilience is continually being hammered one season after another, then of course people start getting stressed. There is tension, there's competition over resources, there's a failure of governance. And that does lead to the situation that we're currently being faced with around the world. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that these events are becoming more extreme, more frequent, and we're going to have to deal with whether you call people climate refugees, displaced. It's a reality of the world. And unless we do much more at the community level, then it's going to become a more prevalent concern. The other thing, so I'll probably just talk for the rest of the podcast.
That makes our jobs much easier.
This is one of the challenges of actually bringing me on and having me live, because you just can't cut off the phone. The other issue is that when you talk about refugees, and I mentioned before that when people cross an international border due to persecution and discrimination, that's when they hit the definition of refugees. The vast majority of people are displaced by extreme weather events and hazards internally. And in some aspects, if you already jump to the term refugees, you're sort of ignoring the huge numbers, the majority of people which are internally displaced. And what we would like to see is much more investment in the communities that are vulnerable, so that people don't have to cross an international border. People don't necessarily want to leave their communities. This is where they've invested not only their lives, but their generations, their communities. No one wants to be displaced. So what we need to do is assess, understand the threats of climate change on the most vulnerable communities and support them so they don't become climate refugees. See, I'm using the word. but in the context that we need to put the protection of individuals first.
Yeah, I think that makes a good point, because we see the discussion about whether there is the term or not, whether that term is important or not, should we should use it or not. But in our work, looking into how climate affects human security, it's never climate alone, right? So that's why it's also probably difficult to come up with this direct term. It is more clear in some cases, like in post-disaster, post-natural disaster context, but still you need to have that lack of governance, the difficult livelihoods, all those gaps that make those climate risks turn into something bigger. So are there climate refugees or economic refugees? It's a difficult one, and it might not be so relevant. So that's a good point and an interesting one.
I'm going to interrupt you and say one more thing. Yeah. On behalf of states of origin. If you talk to a number of small island developing states or even Pakistan during the floods, like, they take offense to saying that their citizens are refugees, because it almost demonstrates that the government is not doing enough to protect them and they're being forced to move. Like, these governments are doing whatever they can given the resources that they've got and given the threats that they've got. So it also, I dare say, undermines the governments and communities' attempts to hold out. And so this is when we start talking about vulnerable populations, the fact that the populations are being impacted by extreme weather events, and this is causing their displacement. But it's a loaded word. And this is why when we say the term climate refugees, it's a good trigger to get a discussion going about some of the other elements. And so, as you can see, I don't generally walk away from these discussions because it brings it back down to how can we help those communities that we know they're going to be most vulnerable, and that we can reinforce issues like governance and climate smart livelihoods and so forth.
And also, like, continuing in the same point, is there, from your perspective, a pattern to climate-induced displacement? Because, of course, if you're here in Europe and you're following media and you're talking to the public, they're going to see the refugees' movements as transcontinental, people coming from developing countries towards Europe, towards the US. That's how they understand in the general public, not everyone, but in the general narrative, so to say. And it's a very strong narrative, too, that shapes politics as well. But when we go back to our work context, the peace-building context, the climate mitigation context, and all these more work-related on-the-ground realities, we see that the patterns of movements of people in post-disasters, that could be slow-onset climate change that is just changing the landscape, or also these like fast disasters that happen at once and force people to move, they don't tend to be transcontinental from our perspective. So how would you see this?
Yeah, there's a lot of hype, and I dare say bordering on xenophobia, which is like anyone who's working in UNHCR or humanitarian agencies dealing with refugees in the field understands what real refugee numbers are. And what humbles me is that generally it's those countries with the least resources and capacity that demonstrate the most generosity. And this is where I was in Kenya earlier this month. I used to work in a whole host of countries, including Jordan. These are the countries that don't really have very much going for them in terms of they've got a lot going for them, but they're also struggling, but they keep the borders open. And it's a classic situation where the people who have probably got them in terms of resources are the ones who are probably the most, how do I put this in a way which is not belittling? They could be doing more to support communities that are being particularly generous. And so when I was in Dadaab refugee camp earlier this month, there was 100,000 people coming across the border. And this is into an area in northern Kenya, which is also being severely impacted by drought, and where the host communities have also lost their livestock, and where the government is also struggling to provide the most basic services. But that being said, that they were welcoming their Somali brothers and sisters, so to speak. And so what we need to be doing is to try, as I mentioned before, trying to identify what the root causes of displacement are, because it's not rocket science to understand what the challenges will be in the future. And if people are forced to cross a border, that they are then provided with support, and not just the refugees, but most important, the host communities. So it's not sufficient just to provide a plastic tent and some water and some food. You need to provide a life, you need to provide a development, you need to support local integration, economic integration of these communities. Because if you don't do that, then yes, people will move further afield. So it's a ridiculous sort of discussion when you've got, let's say, Europe saying that they're worried about the numbers of people coming across, and they think that putting patrols at Lampedusa is going to be the solution. No, the solution is identifying the root causes of conflict and how climate change is going to exacerbate that. So when just in the last couple of months, we're being hit with a situation where one donor after another is saying they're going to have to reduce funding, humanitarian funding. WFP, a key partner in terms of providing humanitarian support for food assistance, they're having to cut their budgets. So what do people do? They either starve, they either forced to join extremist groups, or they move to other locations, they flee to other locations. So this is the type of challenge that we've got. So when people say, okay, what can we anticipate in East Africa or in the Sahel? It's not difficult. You just continue to invest in the wrong things, continue not to ignore the development needs, human dignity, and the results will be clear. We need to invest in not only humanitarian support, but we need to invest in development, and we need to invest in the future of these populations that, due to no fault of their own, they're being hammered by a cascading series of disasters. And this is where there is a responsibility. Like, the whole issue of loss and damage is a very, let's say. It can raise a whole host of emotions, but we are talking about countries, regions, continents that are losing and are being damaged by the lack of ambition and control and emissions. So there's got to be a consequence how that plays out. We don't know, but you can't just say we're going to stop support to Africa or the Middle East and let these countries deal with it themselves.
We're going to come back to funding mechanisms and some of these conversations surrounding loss and damage. And I'm really excited with the bit of sneak peek you've given us to come back to these conversations just a little bit later in the podcast. But first, I want to maybe broaden our conversation a little bit. We've talked a lot about so far climate refugees, the definition behind it, as well as how climate change can help cause displacement. And I think that these topics are often what comes to mind when people think about climate change and mobility. But I would also, you're so often visiting refugee camps or talking with people who have been displaced. How is climate change also affecting people who are currently displaced? And as part of this, do you think that this conversation surrounding the impacts on people who have already had to leave their homes is adequately represented in these conversations surrounding climate change, migration, displacement?
Good point. And I dare say when the High Commissioner appointed me a number of years ago, he said the priority has to be ensuring that refugees and the host communities are supported in building up the resilience and the capacity to adapt. Mm-hmm. So it's not about the future, it's about the populations that are currently at the forefront of climate change. So as I mentioned, the vast majority of refugees and internally displaced originate from areas that are already being impacted by climate change. How that also influences the character of refugee situations is also important, because the prospects or the potential for people to repatriate voluntarily in safety and dignity in a sustainable way is basically gone out the window now. But like people going back to their farms when their farms have failed for year upon year, when the water sources have evaporated, is not likely to occur. So the whole way in which we deal with refugee responses has to also change from what moving away from a short-term, almost naive humanitarian approach, emergency approach, to one where we already understand that these populations are probably not going to return unless there's significant investment in the place of origin. And we need to be investing in development. We need to be investing in adaptation. And so one of the key areas that I think UNHCR has been successful is being working with development agencies, particularly the World Bank, to support host governments to invest. And that investment is then linked to supporting refugees' local integration. So moving away from the concept of dependency, which has probably characterized refugee responses for years, to one where we support the host governments as much as we possibly can with development funding. So the money's not coming through UNHCR, but it's directly from the multilateral development banks to the governments. And that way that they see that there's a net benefit from absorbing the refugees into their communities, because there is a benefit. Like when you have refugees setting up businesses, when you have investments in renewable energy, better water management, so you have more partners being engaged, there's a net benefit to the overall community. So this is how we're approaching things. But if you also look at when we went to Dadaab refugee camp on the Somali border in Kenya earlier this month, it was atrocious. It was horrible. And one of my colleagues from Somalia had not visited there for 7 years, and he said the situation had not changed. We still had 100,000 people coming across the border in the last couple of months. And it was when you ask, you've got these indicators, like how many latrines are there per person? This is the new arrivals, and they're saying there was one per 100. There was not enough money to provide decent shelter, so we gave plastic sheeting, but there was no structures to provide that plastic sheeting, so people had to go out and cut wood to provide the frames. There was the food rations were being cut. There was no schools. There was health centers, but quite poorly serviced. And when you talk to the refugees who have arrived from Somalia and you just say, under what circumstances would you return, given the fact that this is like hell on earth and it's only going to get worse, they say, there's no way we're going back. even that situation where you had dust storms coming through, where you had no latrines, where food had been cut by 50%, where the kids weren't going to school, not many of them, that was still a better situation than what they had left from. Yeah. So this is a long-winded way to say that we need to be investing in infrastructure. We need to be investing in shelter, because otherwise we're just leaving these populations to the mercy of an increasingly hostile climate.
Yeah. I always find it interesting. Interesting is definitely not the right word, but maybe a diplomatic way to say, because often with these kinds of funding cycles that exist, you have this kind of infrastructure set up because they're only prepared for the next 6 months. And then in the end, okay, needs to be renewed. All the infrastructure is ruined, needs to be rebuilt. And in the end, you have 7 years later, and it actually would have been much more cost efficient just to build something more sustainable and adapt to the situation from the start, as opposed to constantly having these short-term kind of band-aids on the problem. Yeah, so that kind of is the perfect segue to discussing some of these funding mechanisms that exist, maybe a little bit more in detail. Because I think in the last year, with loss and damage becoming more of a conversation, there's really been a magnifying glass on making funding not only and increasing the amount of funding when it comes to climate finance, but also making sure that these kinds of mechanisms are actually accessible to fragile and conflict-affected contexts and states, communities. And I know you were also at the Africa Climate Summit, which had a very big focus on climate finance and making sure that there was enough. So in the broader sense, how can we make these kinds of funding mechanisms more accessible and actually lead to long-term investment, more assistance that works in the long term for these communities? And do you think the Africa Climate Summit sufficiently brought some of these concerns to a wider stage and more of the global conversation that's happening? A very long-winded question. So I'll pause a little bit as you can collect your thoughts.
Okay. I'm probably not going to be able to answer all those.
Perfect.
I'll just
come back to the questions.
My memory is like a goldfish. So not only have we had the Africa Climate Summit, we've also had the SDGs climate ambitions. And did anything significant or transformative come out of that? No. So it's basically the same old same. It's almost like you've got countries trying to buy time without making accountable, demonstrable commitments. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where, so the SG was saying, don't bother coming unless you're willing to make a commitment. People didn't come. you've got Biden, which turned up, but the other four did not. Mm-hmm. How does that reflect in terms if you're a hosting state on the front lines? Same with Ruto, the Kenyan president, like brilliant job in bringing a lot of the leaders from Africa to the event, but it's no use bringing the leaders unless you can have that sort of that parallel engagement from the developed countries. Mm-hmm. And so when you're dealing with refugees, you don't have the luxury of believing what people say. Not when you've got millions of people depending
on. You need to see the money and see the impact. Political rhetoric only goes zero.
Yeah, so you've got countries like, I'm saying Kenya because Kenya was the host, like Kenya's just sort of saying, look, like we have loosened up our laws, but we're not prepared to go any further unless we see some money. And so it's now sort of a challenge in terms of the $100 billion. What does that actually mean? You've got a loss and damage facility, but it's an empty bucket at the moment. And so if you're a country which is hosting refugees and you're being, again, hit one day after another by these disasters, who do you actually believe and trust? And then you've got agencies like UNHCR and ICRC and the World Food Programme that are being, their budgets are being cut. So governments are then saying to us, okay, you've made these commitments to provide more support, but we're not seeing that. We're seeing excuses about why you can't provide more support. So it's not an issue that's for the future. We are seeing governments restrict their protection of people in need, and including their mobility, because we just don't have the money. There is potential for people to return home in Southern Africa. We don't have money to support the repatriation. So this is where we are, like an absolute crux in terms of the humanitarian development peace building nexus. And that's got to be addressed as much as possible. So the other issue when we're talking about when you do have climate funding, and there is a lot of discussion, there's no doubt about that, but we have to emphasize it has to be new and additional. It can't be taken away from the humanitarian side of things. Like, there was a report which came out over the last couple of days that said that already some of the core development funding for some of the fragile and conflict affected states has reduced in order to pay for the climate. So you are already seeing that diversion of funding and put in other buckets. But what does that mean for us on the front lines? It means that we don't have enough money to deliver. We need more humanitarian funding, we need more development funding, and we need more climate funding. But it needs to be put in a way that you have a collective vision and collective accountability to what that's going to deliver. Because you mentioned before about the challenges of dealing with an emergency budget cycle versus a development budget cycle. If you have a refugee influx at the moment, which, like going to Chad, for instance, you had 400,000 people cross in the last few months. So it's not small numbers that we're dealing with. You've had 1 million people overall flee from Sudan. It's often easier for us to get money for water trucking than it is to drill wells, because you've got, everyone complains about the UN, sometimes rightly, but what we're also being challenged with is that donors are also very much siloed between their emergency humanitarian response, development funding, and peace building and security. And now they've got another one, which is climate. So what I'd be calling for is saying, look, we understand, including through the good work of Adelphi, we understand where these threats and challenges will be. There will be increased human vulnerability brought about by climate change. That vulnerability will lead to conflict and displacement. So if we know that, why don't we do something about it together rather than just expecting, oh, okay, there's going to be a conflict, so ICRC can do something, UNHCR can do something, World Food Program can do something. Like, we need to get the development agencies on board. We need to get those countries who are interested in the more stable Northern Africa, Sahel, Eastern Horn of Africa, Southern Asia, for instance. If we focus on a collective outcome, obviously involving the communities themselves in determining what the outcome is that they want, then we can start having a much better investment. I still of the opinion that there's a lot of money out there. It's just not going to the right places. Like, the multilateral development funds, climate funds are just not geared up to provide support to where it's most needed. And sorry.
No, I was just going to say, do you think more flexible funding, maybe specifically within UN institutions from your perspective, is an achievable goal? When we always talk about we need better financing, that also means more flexible. Are there institutional barriers that you think will continue to pose a challenge for the years coming? Or do you see a pathway that this can actually be achieved?
It's certainly possible, because it has to happen.
it's possible because it has to happen.
So it's just bringing everyone together. Like, if you see any reports written in terms of how to enhance the resilience or adaptation of communities, it's like the menu or the recipe is already there, but we just now need to move to the next step. So we know that communities on the front lines are being most impacted, need the money to go to them. It's no use getting stuck in a capital. So then if you need the money to get to the communities, then you need to have projects which meet their requirements. And so that then means you need to talk to the people, and not just talk to the people. You need to listen to the people and let them take that responsibility. But you've still got this absolute risk-averse approach. You've got our friends in International Committee for Red Cross who have challenges in trying to get money to deal with climate in areas which are not controlled by governments. So this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue, because as you've got the ability of governments to govern across all their territory, does that mean that we ignore the populations so that are not under that strict governance, or that there's been a coup recently, which has happened more and more in certain parts? So we have to be much more realistic in terms of, are we serious about helping those people who are most vulnerable so that we can support their adaptation and resilience? And so that does mean in terms making more money available for those countries that are most in need. And we know those countries, like, it's all been mapped out, like what countries are most at risk. So is it available? Was it accessible? And is it affordable? And then you start breaking it down. So, like, how do we get money? Maybe it's, for instance, rather than the World Bank giving 50 million, probably get in trouble now. World Bank should still give $50 million. rather than giving $50 million, maybe it's better to give $5,000 or $10,000, $5,000 grants to farmers. Mm-hmm. Why not try it and just see what difference that makes? So lots of things that we can be doing, but it's got to be one where we're working together towards a common vision. And I still just don't see that. I still see that there's a reactive approach when there's so much data and evidence out there to inform policy and decision making.
I don't think there's a single podcast episode or a single brief, policy brief report that we work on in which the lack of coordination or the siloed funding or the different goals that different organizations are pursuing, the different mandates that they have and that they are working towards, and their lack of coordination as a problem. And also in the recommendations, in not just our work in Adelphi, but other organizations that we partner with, that we work with, or from the community in general, it always comes up because the solution is integrated, but the reality is siloed. It's even kind of a UN word. The word siloed became like a bit of a fun way to refer to when the siloed funding is a siloed mandates and everything, but the solutions being integrated. That's an issue. And I think we're going to keep hammering at that nail until it comes in. There's really no going around.
There's an expression that I heard the other day, which I'll not take credit for, but things just pop up and it's probably popped up for a long time, but I only heard it. There's no humanitarian solution for a humanitarian crisis. It's something which is so simple. So when you throw humanitarian agencies into an issue which is systematic related to poor governance, the impacts of climate change, then you're just trying to hold ground and you're going to fail. So what we're calling for and what we're incrementally making, the headway with, and I mentioned the World Bank, but also IFC, is that we need the development agencies to come closer to the start of the crisis. There's a few positive things that I take out of the current challenge, and that is that there's an increasing push for that coordination and collaboration because there's an understanding about how existential the threat is towards many communities. Yesterday, there was discussion in terms of societal collapse. We probably haven't got there yet, but we're seeing communities collapse. And we're seeing in Somalia and even parts of eastern Ethiopia and parts of northern Kenya where you've got communities that were pastoral and after 4, 5, 6 failed seasons, their previous way of living is not sustainable. And so they've already moved. So you've got these almost depopulation of certain areas already occurring. And what happens then, and particularly in places like Somalia, is you've got non-state actors taking advantage of that and moving in to occupy that vacuum. And then possibly encouraging other people or communities to move as well, because the level of governance is very weak. So this is where you've got this whole climate nexus, security, human security, lack of livelihoods coming into play. And so it's not just a humanitarian response, it's very much the development response, it's the peace building security response. And now the quadruple nexus, it's got to be the climate response.
And also even if you have, for example, just to based on your example of pastoralists losing their livelihood, this can also affect the environment itself. It's a land management strategy. It has been for hundreds, maybe perhaps thousands of years. And if that strategy is not there anymore because the environment is not allowing and the economic conditions are not allowing, the social economic conditions, what is going to happen to the local environment? Even the landscape might change without this kind of management. And I wanted to just mention something. I was in July in a workshop in Switzerland in the context of the Call Dialogue series on environment and security. And we were talking a lot within this workshop on how can funding trickle down to the actual communities and not get stopped at, like you said, the capitals or stay within bigger organizations and why these small organizations don't have access to funding. And it's not just a matter of how much money is available, but also maybe not fulfilling the criteria to access the funding that are already there, and thinking how much organizations can actually support in this kind of low-hanging fruits, easier ways, helping communities have the access, so to say, fulfill the criteria, fill in these grant proposals, or do things that are on the practical side difficult. There are language barriers, there are barriers in terms of navigating bureaucracy that are we call it low-hanging fruits because there's just a matter of someone sitting and solving it. But for the community that is dealing with these issues and it's not familiar with this kind of processes, it just makes funding inaccessible, even when it's there. So I just wanted to bring that into the mix because it's not always about not having enough money, right?
All good points, and probably something I cannot answer within an hour. But one thing which we're trying to do, and this is pushing the much more of a collective vision, collective understanding, is that we're working with IGAD, which is the organization which deals with Eastern Horn of Africa. It's got, let me get this right, I think 9 countries which are members. And there is a big push, which we're also very much supporting, to have a regional adaptation strategy. And that regional adaptation strategy, I think, is trying to address the points that you're making. We know what the challenges are going to be because we've got really good modeling and data and trend analysis. We know what the populations will be in the future. We know the crops that will survive, the livestock that will die, the increasing unpredictability of weather. So we've got all that. But given all the challenges, and what are we going to do about it? And so that's the next step. So what we've been working on is not only to come up with an adaptation strategy, but to work with others who are interested in the well-being of the Eastern Horn of Africa to come up with best practices, including policies that work in the region. For instance, there is a free movement protocol which is in place for the IGAD region. What type of smart agriculture that can be invested? How do we do better water management? Issues that transcend national borders and which each country has got an interest in. And then what we want to try and do is have what are the projects that can be best suited to be addressing adaptation. And one thing which is super important is not just to rely on the leaders when you're talking to them. You need to involve the women and the youth, because if you have focus group sessions of men, the leaders generally, then they'll be focusing much more on a market-based response. They'll be focusing on the camels and the trucks and how do we get to markets, whereas the women will be, and I don't want to sort of be a gross generalization here, but when we talk to the women, it's much more about the family food cycle. It'll be about healthcare. It'll be about education. It'll be about the future.
It's so, about not perpetuating the status quo, precisely, yes. Right?
Yeah, and so this is where a lot of these conferences just end up with nothingness, because you're dealing with people who focus on the past, which is not going to be leading to a sustainable future. And so bringing the youth, the women, indigenous populations to the fore, they may not have all the answers, but they've got to be much more engaged. And one thing which I think we did, which was really successful this month, was that prior to the Africa Climate Summit, we were able to convince the Director General of COP28, Ambassador Majid Al-Sawadi, to come to Dadaab. And so this was the first time that there's ever been a COP presidency or a senior member of the COP presidency go to the front lines of the climate/conflict emergency. And so we basically took him to one of the most vulnerable, insecure locations. I didn't really tell him all that beforehand, but he was up for it. We got out of the armored vehicles. He was in the tents talking to women. What we did not want is a big entourage around him, but he spoke to women who had walked for days, who had lost children on the way. Like, losing children when you're fleeing and then saying, I'm still not going to go back, is pretty important. And so when he came out of that and we were talking to him, he said, like, this meant more to me than all the meetings that I've attended this year. And so this is the type of thing that we've got to, like, having meetings in Dubai or Sharm el-Sheikh or in Berlin, like, it's important, but it doesn't show the reality to the decision makers. Yeah. And so this goes back to, I forget what even the question was, but it goes back that, now I do, that unless you get people to understand what the impact is on people being forced to cross a border due to conflict and climate, then they'll take an easy route in terms of making funding available to communities. But what I was able to say to the team was, look, now that you're witness to this growing tragedy, every decision that you make in terms of the buzzwords of accessibility, it has to apply to this community in Dadaab. So if it doesn't reach these women, and I say women here because, like, they can be much more trusted in terms of protecting the environment and their families. If it doesn't reach the women, then we're failing. And so the women were saying, like, you empower us. This is despite everyone, despite them walking for weeks to get to this godforsaken place on earth. They were saying, if you can empower us, we will empower the youth and we will empower the communities. So we don't need huge apparatus. We just need a system that works. And as much money as possible getting down to that location and being accountable. And so what we have been seeking to achieve is to do a stock take of national adaptation plans, NDC plans, National Determined Contribution plans, disaster risk reduction plans, early warning plans, to make sure that when governments, including host governments, develop these plans, that they take into account a whole of society approach. Number one, just don't disenfranchise those most vulnerable groups. I'm obviously coming from the refugee agency, so we want refugees to be covered, but it should also include migrants, it should include indigenous populations, it should include manners of sort of ways in which the most vulnerable are aware of the funds that are coming in. One of the things when we say how to use money more effectively, it's just also ensuring that there's proper communication and transparency. Because if you just give the money to a ministry or a department or an organization, and you don't tell the people who are supposed to benefit from this what they're supposed to achieve, then of course nothing's going to happen. But if you tell the populations that this is what you're entitled to and this is what you should expect, then you've got that bottom-up approach towards accountability. That's why in a refugee situation, we generally have signs which say every person is able to access this amount of food, this amount of rice or sugar or cooking oil. You don't have to pay for services, education's free. So this is, it's simple. It doesn't cost anything to communicate and respect people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of some within the Peace Pillar initiative part of Weathering Risk here at Adelphi. Berghof is participating with a project in Somalia that involves these local infrastructures for peace, which really goes to highlight how long they've had relationships with community members so they can actually bring these people you've outlined to the dialogue. Because of course, it sounds really nice. We want to make sure that women are represented in these conversations, youth, indigenous people have been marginalized. But if you don't have strong relationships with the communities you're working in, as an organization that has the funds, the resources to come in, you can end up doing more harm, perpetuating some of these solutions that don't actually work for communities. But when you have these really long-lasting relationships, you're able to do so much more and actually bring these people to the table, discussions, and make solutions that actually work for every person in the community. No. I feel like we've gotten sidetracked.
We did. No, and there were also a few questions I wanted to ask you that we got into already. For example, I wanted to ask you whether visits or joint visits to refugee camps or to the front lines of where the issues are held for decision makers. And that was a clear yes from your side. Very helpful for people to get to see. I think we had a similar experience with the Lake Chad humanitarian crisis in 2017 that members of the, if I'm not mistaken, the UN Security Council visited the region, and immediately after you had resolutions and the matter flowing much more fast in the Security Council itself. So it makes a difference, right? I'm saying this and we're mentioning this very actively here in the podcast, because if you're not there and seeing the reactions and seeing the action happening after a visit, it's going to seem like a photo op. It's good to know that there is a logic behind it and that it supports the cause. Another thing that we also addressed that I wanted to ask, but we addressed already, is impacts of the response itself. So you mentioned, for example, people having to cut down trees because they received the plastic sheeting but didn't receive the structure. So this is an example of our own responses to the issues causing environmental or also security impacts can happen. We had this example also in the Lake Chad region where people received the food aid, but no fuel for cooking. So they also had to deforest the region, also go out of the camp into insecure areas. So it's also good to reflect on our own impact. It was really good to hear from you the example. My question now would be, because we tend to see disasters as something that is out of control, of course, now speaking of the fast onset natural disasters, but there are, in fact, cases in which preparedness has played an important role in preventing and also reducing loss of life, or also loss of economic damage. One case that I've been hearing about a lot since last year is Bangladesh and having good early warning systems. Do you have some examples to share about where preparedness and early warnings, or something that worked well rather than the negative focus we generally tend to have?
I've got to say yes, and then I'll think about it. I think the preparedness side has got to be based on obviously anticipating what the threats and vulnerabilities will be coming online. And so is there more understanding of where these vulnerable areas will be? Absolutely. And again, the work of Adelphi and PIC and CGIAR, like UNHCR as a humanitarian agency has probably never invested so much working with scientists and academia. So that's a good thing, because we now know where these threats and tension points will occur and probably where conflicts will break out. So being an advocate for those people in terms of identifying that we need to be prepared to deal with potential conflict or climatic impacts is already a start. And so the fact that we're even talking about it here is a start. The fact that we've now got the World Bank working very closely with us in conflict-affected areas is also a really significant achievement, because you can have partnerships, but unless it actually brings about funding, then it's just talk. For instance, our High Commissioner recently went to Chad with the Director of Operations of the World Bank, and subsequent to that, whether they're going to do it or not, doesn't matter. But they provided, I think, another $300 million to Chad. That was on top of the $2 billion that had been provided before to support a whole host of things in Chad. But that, I dare say, helped with ensuring that Chad keeps its borders open and maintains a very pro-refugee response. But if that support did not come from a development agency and they're just relying on UNHCR and NGOs and our partners, then that degree of generosity or feeling of solidarity would be somewhat, let's say, tainted. So I think that is a really good example. I think the fact that there's more and more donor states understanding the confluence between climate and conflict and displacement is also super important. So even today, I'm talking to the German Foreign Office, talking to BMZ. All these are important elements in order to move the discussion forward from just a reactive approach to anticipating what's going on. You mentioned the issue of refugees and even host communities cutting down trees. That's something which can also not only be preparedness, but it's also, if we understand that these refugee camps are going to turn into settlements and probably cities, and that if there's no alternative source of energy, then they're going to cut down trees. And we can calculate it's going to be between 1 to 1.9 kilos of biomass per person per day. And if you're dealing with 400,000 new arrivals, then you start talking about tens of thousands of tons of trees. And so if you don't address that, then you're going to have the host communities, host populations, become increasingly intolerant, because who wants to see their forests, their environments destroyed? So preparedness also means anticipating where these tension points will be. And so I know that, for instance, you've got Bezos Earth Fund. Like, how do we get them more involved in also addressing refugee locations? We've got to try and encourage those entities that have been making commitments to also move into areas which may be outside of their comfort zone.
Yes, vulnerable contexts or conflict-affected contexts where you need it the most. It's generally donor-averse.
No? Yeah, so. And so we've got to hold them accountable. It's like, it's nice to be planting trees in Costa Rica or Ghana or something like that, but it's Somalia, it's Kenya, it's Tanzania, because we're interested in trees, but we're even more interested in people. Because if you don't protect the environment, you can't expect the communities to protect the refugees. And so it's very clear, again, like linkage, that there's probably no agencies other than UNEP, which is probably more interested in the well-being of the environment in these locations than UNHCR, because the environment has a very clear ramification on whether people are going to be protected or not.
So often when we have these kinds of topics on the podcast, talking about climate change, conflict, displacement of communities, it's very easy to leave the recording studio, whether it be in person or virtual, and you just feel not bad, but it's but maybe actually that's accurate.
That doesn't give me much.
But certainly not great.
Yeah.
And we've talked so far a lot of challenges when it comes to funding. Mm-hmm. Maybe with a bit of hope, looking at what may be possible, but so far we're not there. And one thing we've certainly highlighted is the importance of working with communities who are affected and actually making sure these solutions meet their need. So as we start to look at the end of our conversation coming up, I was hoping you could share some community-led solutions, anything from technical climate smart solutions to different capacity building mechanisms that kind of make, as cheesy as it sounds, make you hopeful in your daily work and make this something you can work on for such an extensive amount of time.
Absolutely. If you look at the global picture, you think it's just a hopeless case. Maybe we should cut that out. But when you go, the closer you go down to the field, the more inspired and you want to do more. Mm-hmm. This is why we're so engaged. This is why UNHCR has 500 plus offices around the world. And we've got no choice. We work with the populations. And then if you're talking to people and you're talking to these women and they're just saying, look, just give us the opportunity to survive. Just give us the ability to be empowered, sustain our families. Then you've got hope. The youth are there. They want to work. They want to go to school. And so it's only when you start moving away from the field that you start getting people who feel tired and you get to Europe and people start saying, oh, we don't want to provide support. We don't want people here. But when you talk to even the government officials, like often government officials in some of these states get a hard time. But Somalia, I've probably not met more committed, engaged, educated believers in the future of Somalia than what I have. And that's probably one of the reasons why we're trying to drive support in that region so much, because there has to be a belief that you can make a difference. You just can't leave people in their situation.
The famous political will that we hear about, that would be a good example of it.
Absolutely. And listening to particularly women, like it's just too easy to, as I mentioned before, to invite leaders who are not representative of the populations on the front line. You get ministers coming from capitals, but that's not the people who are very much, again, on the borders. Oh, I was in Colombia earlier this year, and very good examples of inclusion of displaced people. Because they've had to deal with civil war for so many years, they understand what the impacts of conflict and displacement and death is. And so they're doing whatever they possibly can to put in laws, support the integration of people who have been displaced, not only by conflict, but also by climate. So this is another thing which we need to be looking at. How do we get money to cities and communities rather than going through capitals? Argentina, Costa Rica, Ecuador. The more that you actually dive into these areas that are being impacted by climate change, but sometimes conflict, the more that you see there's actually a lot going on out there in terms of trying to provide the protection for people who are on the move.
Do you think this is an actual barrier when it comes to donor? It seems like a lot of donors, donor governments, of course, want to give funding to other governments. And I know I've seen proposals for maybe religious organizations that are more prominent in communities to be kind of receivers of funding and being able to distribute it to local populations. Are there any, because I think it's easy for us to say, oh, this doesn't work. They need to get to the community on the local level. But are there any things that you've either seen work, like in these contexts on getting money to communities directly, or any things that policy could possibly aim towards or grow towards?
There's any government, they have bilateral relations with other governments. And so it could be for a whole host of reasons, but they try and maintain a solid foundation. And so there could be partnerships, there could be coalitions, there could be strategic positioning. So we have to recognize that the interests of one government will generally match the interests of the other government. But that does not say that we should not put in place mechanisms and communications and best practices to ensure that the money actually gets down to the community. And that's what I was mentioning before, that inform the communities what they're entitled to. At least give them the opportunity to know that there should be a bridge being built, or that the amount of food that they should be receiving should be X and it should be on such and such a day across. And again, not just to the leaders, to the whole community. So communication is super important. We need to change the way in which climate financing and multilateral development banks provide funding, even concessional loans, because as you're also aware, loans that often go to conflict-affected states are at sometimes five times the interest rates of what, let's say, European states can access. So it just basically increases the indebtedness of these states. And so we're trying to push, with our friends, a much more increased recognition that if countries are already hosting refugees, that they're providing an international service. And if they're also being impacted by climate change, which is exacerbating or challenging that international good, then they should be rewarded. Maybe rewarding is not the right word, but compensated is also not the right word. It should be recognized that they are doing something on behalf of the international community. Much like Brazil saying now that we will try and protect the Amazon rainforest as a public good. So you've got host communities that are already doing that with refugees as a public good or public common. So how do we start recognizing this much more seriously in terms of climate financing?
Yeah, I think that really goes to highlight how important, as we've mentioned time and time again, communication, even when it comes to funding, it's not just, okay, we've identified someone to give funding to, but actually engaging, even if it's just in conversation and building those relationships. I know we've kept the conversation going for quite some time, but before we start to wrap it up and maybe look to COP, is there anything that you want to share with the listeners, with the audience, before we round it out? No pressure.
Been talking for it. No, just that this issue is going to become more and more critical. As I said, we've got no option but to make changes. But those changes should not be from COP28 down. It's got to be driven from the communities and understanding what are the dreams and aspirations that the communities have for their future. And how do we bring that to the decision makers? But at the moment, it's very much decision makers. You've got countries, very influential countries, that are trying to block funding going in terms of climate adaptation, loss and damage. We can't put all our eggs in the COP28 basket, not when it's based on consensus. We've got to make our own changes. We've got to have our own wins, like whether it be influencing the German government or the EU or the UN trying to work more effectively. It's a process. It's an incremental process. Every meeting and conference and visit that anyone undertakes or participates in should be coming up with an outcome which moves the needle in the right way. Because at the moment, I still see that the ambition is not only short of what's required, but in some aspects, countries are actually backtracking on previous commitments when they should be becoming even more ambitious. And I think this is why the Secretary General is becoming even more apocalyptic in terms of his discussion. So you can't say that we're concerned about the future when you're basically undercutting the future.
I like the way you put that. We can't put all of our eggs in one basket, because I think especially around this time of year, you start to see everything like events on social media, newsletters, and everything is the road to COP. Yeah. COP, COP, COP.
And even within COP, the Peace Day, which has been amazing for the security and peace building communities to have a day that is dedicated for their areas of work. Even within COP, we're still putting, really, we can see that the community is putting all their eggs in one basket, at least for the time being, for the coming months.
But if you go to, I don't know whether you've been to COPs, but it's just like there's panels after panels where people are talking and no one's listening. It's just like, so
it's about being there.
It's about being there. But unless you actually come up with concrete outcomes, then it's, again, people will sponsor pavilions. They'll put up what they're actually doing, but what are they actually doing? Mm-hmm. And I think this is where you've got to start challenging people and saying, okay, what difference have you made since the last COP? This is the 28th COP. Like what, mm-hmm. are we on the right track? Are we seeing population stabilized? Are we having better community participation? No, like, so you've got some discussions which are quite polemic, but you've got a lot of discussions which are just taking the easy option out because others do not want to question each other on their lack of progress on these issues. Mm-hmm. But it's when you get to the ground and when you're on a border with another country, or there's been a country that's faced another coup, that you start saying, okay, maybe things are not going the right way. Maybe we have to change things significantly.
Yeah. I think it's also easy for people to have so much of a focus on these kinds of international fora like COP because it is so prevalent in the news media. You can't open a newspaper, you can't open whatever journal you receive without seeing the headlines. Where would you suggest that people also look to for some of these accomplishments, some of these measurable things that actually drive impact and lead us to where we need to go? How can people get the same, not like emotional reaction, but where you feel so invested in COP is happening, maybe there's going to be a change? Where else can they find some of these stories, some of these things to believe in a little bit, invest time in to learn about?
Straight after COP, we've got the Global Refugee Forum. So it's going to be much more focused in terms of refugees and host communities. And there we're seeking to get governments, both developed donor governments, working with host governments to address key challenges, climate being one of those. And so how do we get host governments to include refugees in national adaptation plans, national determined contribution plans, early warning systems? So you've got that element. to be inclusive. But then we're saying to donor governments, if you're making climate funds or development funds available, prioritize these countries which would not normally prioritize because they're dealing with hosting refugees, but they're also on the front lines of climate change. So that's the type of changes that we can see, because is there more money going to fragile and conflict-affected states or not? Is it more accessible or not? A lot of governments will say that they're limited because the funding is going through multilateral development funds or the Green Climate Fund or the Environmental Fund, but they're shareholders. They can actually determine the parameters of whether money is accessible, affordable, and available. So you can remember that now. And so there's almost a meeting per week. There's a board meeting. There's a shareholder meeting. There's a decision on funding. So what I will ask people is just check whether these funding decisions make sense. What are the conditions that countries which are hosting refugees and are on the front lines of the climate crisis, is there any sort of concessional loans or grants being provided? What was the involvement of women and children in the decision-making? So for COP28 and the Global Refugee Forum, we will be bringing in not only us, but our partners as well. We'll be bringing refugees and affected communities. But that's okay, because they'll have a chance to speak. But what is more important is that they're empowered. It's not enough just to bring them in sort of like photo opportunity. You need to be able to listen to them, take into account what they say, what their vision is, what their aspirations are, and then make sure the funding and resources get them to make that difference. What is key for them? Is it health? Is it education? Is it employment? So these are the type of things that we need to be doing much more. And there's a saying, which is also well known, like no decision about us without us. Mm-hmm. And that's something which is not necessarily the case.
Perfect. So I think
that
now we
is
can
very comprehensive.
Yeah.
Definitely our longest podcast.
Exactly.
To date.
And I think maybe in just a simple way to wrap up this conversation, since we have had such long discussions, but how you put it, it's possible because it needs to happen. There is no other alternative when it comes to finding climate change solutions that work for conflict and vulnerable communities and countries in order to actually support communities there and lead to sustainable livelihoods, healthy lives, and things like that. It needs to happen. And whether or not it comes through decisions in these big kind of conferences like COP, or more likely they happen on the weekly basis on these site visits, on bringing affected communities to some of these conferences to actively have a say in what they need and what kind of funding support is actually accessible and workable for them is really key. So thanks so much for joining us. We're so glad we got to do this in person.
Yeah, and thank you so much. It was so comprehensive. It was so multi-sided. We talked about so many things. I lost track. I'm super excited. It was really good. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate this different format that we had today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.